They call people like me traditionalists, as if we're something set apart. We've lost the language of the church. We've lost its wonder and mystery by pretending it isn't there. We've lost the bloody plot, and we're in danger of reducing Christianity to a kind of comfortable old jumper that you can put on or take off as the mood suits you. A miraculous piece of clothing that'll absolve you from all wrongdoing and lead you to some package trip for eternity. What the hell, Charlie? I don't need to preach to you. You probably do, Gregory, but we haven't the time now. Maybe I'll come back with Bex and have our marriage blessed. It'd be a pleasure. Charlie looked up, sensing movement. The lanky brother Simon stood in the doorway. Well, Gregory sounded stern, unforgiving. Three seem to be absent, Father Superior. Simon's been doing a head count for me, Gregory Scott explained to Charlie. Who's missing, then? Father Benedict, brothers Vitus and Lapsi, just like you suspected, Father. The Father Superior crossed himself. When Bex and Patsy Wright had flown into Ringmarookie on board the Chinook, they had peered toward the ocean-going yacht as it sliced through the breakers, about a mile east of the small harbour, picking up speed, and seemingly heading toward the Western Isles. What few people knew was that the Russian toughs, Vitus and Lapsi, had long been in the pay of Ilyich Antonovich Chermiet. Their job had been to watch Colin Knight, the self-styled Father Benedict. Chermiet had suspected Knight for a long while, and always knew where he could pick him up. In the early hours, Chermiet decided that the false Father Benedict would have to pay for lining his pockets, for Colin Knight had not been too scrupulous in the handling of Chermiet's funds. Vitus and Lapsi had laid hold of the novice master and taken him by force down to the yacht, where Chermiet waited silently, ready to inflict punishment and seek retribution. By shortly after 11:30 on the same morning, Golden Cockatrice had spotted the freighter off Rathlin Island just as she ducked into the North Channel, running between the coasts of Scotland and Ireland. For vital minutes they sheltered on her port side, shielding themselves from the shoreline, from radar and any prying eyes. Nobody saw the inflatable leave the yacht and streak toward the freighter. One man was in the stern, and a monk lay in what on a larger vessel would be called the forecastle, two deck hands hanging onto the chains they'd put around the captive's hands and ankles. The inflatable swept in toward the freighter, which now rode at half speed ahead, with nets and a kind of bosun's chair on ropes and pulleys over the side, to haul the monk on board. For 3 days, Chermiet had been in constant radio contact with the freighter, which was registered in Odessa, and inappropriately named Tsar Ivan IV. Had any former Tsar seen this salt-caked rust bucket, the result would have been truly terrible. Now, as the inflatable reached the side of the freighter, Golden Cockatrice turned away and headed north at full speed. In the inflatable, the man in the monk's habit was retching, throwing up over the side, his face green and drawn, eyes ringed red, and snot running from his nose. His illness had little to do with the sea, for Colin Knight had always been a good sailor. He was ill now because of the beating Chermiet and the two Russians had given him in the forward lounge of Golden Cockatrice, during which he had admitted embezzling large sums of money. He had even given Chermiet the numbers of secret bank accounts in Luxembourg and on the Cayman Islands, and the code words that would unlock them. Now every movement caused the man pain, and Chermiet threatened much worse once they got him on board. The freighter was bound for Felixstowe, where she would pick up half a dozen containers full of second-hand cars, mostly Ladas, Mercs, and BMWs, that had been stolen in the UK and would be carried to the Federation of Russian States and sold for king's ransom prices. This was a regular trip for Tsar Ivan IV, though on this occasion she'd been delayed 3 days with engine trouble off the northern coast of Ireland. Nor was this her usual or direct route. Rather, it was a scenic route that added many nautical miles to the journey. Both the navigation and the engine trouble had been on the orders of I.A. Chermiet, the chairperson of the consortium, that owned Tsar Ivan IV. This was Chermiet's ride into the UK. The man in monk's robes was swung inboard and dropped onto the freighter's deck, so that he sobbed with pain. One of the deckhands even felt a twinge of sorrow for the man, for he knew what awaited him below in the empty hold. He had helped build the instrument of death. Now he helped lift him and carry him down into the depths of the ship, as Chermiet climbed aboard, swarming up the net that had been dropped for him. Below him, the two other men now secured the inflatable, then followed their leader while the small craft was lifted on board. Later that evening she would be needed again, so they disguised her by covering her with a tarp, leaving her near to where she could be swung out again. Chermiet clambered straight up to the bridge to shake his captain's hand. "Everything arranged?" Chermiet asked in Russian. 10:30 tonight," the captain said, nodding. Chermiet gave him a grim smile. "Good. You'll make yourself available to come with me. Now I shall see to our passenger. Posing as one of Christ's brothers brings Christ's reward." Vitus waited at the companionway. He carried a clutch of thick, sharp wooden stakes, shaped like huge nails, and a sturdy mallet. "Ladislav's gone down with the rope," he told Chermiet, who simply nodded and led the way down, his body turned sideways to more easily negotiate the companionways. In the aft hold, the engine noise was louder, reverberating throughout the ship's hull, a deep, booming thrum that had just increased as the captain had ordered full ahead all from the bridge. The ship rocked slightly and trembled as she picked up the revolutions. In the hold, the elderly man who was Colin Knight lay trembling on the metal deck, his eyes wide and incredulous as he tried to make sense of the great wooden cross that lay nearby. The cross had been fashioned from two thick planks of wood, jointed and nailed together. His mind would not accept that these people could be inhuman enough to use such a thing. In London, Ronnie Richardson left Tessa Murray in the Royal Garden Hotel while he took a cab to Piccadilly Circus, then walked through Soho until he found an ironmonger's shop in one of the narrow back streets. The sign above the window said that the owner was a J. Grant and that he was an ironmonger and metal engraver. The shop was closed, but a fat man with a bulbous nose opened up when Ronnie pressed the bell three times. "Josh in?" Ronnie asked, keeping his hands away from his body and showing them to be empty. "Who wants him?" The fat man stared at Ronnie as though he'd asked an obscure question. "Tell him it's Walter from Germany." The fat man nodded, said nothing, and lumbered away, disappearing through a door at the rear of the shop. Richardson took a step inside the door and sniffed at the metallic smell and traces of leather. He remembered as a child he had great pleasure in shops that displayed and sold leather. He would breathe in the scent of the leather, then chew at the corners of his tongue. This gave him a frisson of almost sexual excitement. A couple of minutes later, the fat man returned, breathing heavily, not happy about exerting himself.
"You got a number, Walter?"
"Yes, 141.
"You're to go up, then."
Over the years, Ronnie must have visited this shop some 20 times, yet the routine never varied. Same fat man, same dialogue. Absolutely no familiarity. Through the door, a steep, wooden, uncarpeted staircase led up to a long room cluttered with the grey boxes of computers and their peripherals. In one corner stood a small dormouse of a man, sliding a tray of glossy paper into a large, sophisticated colour laser printer. The dormouse grinned at Ronnie.
"Hello, Walt. Long time no see. How are you keeping?"
He had a high-pitched voice, almost unnatural. Having fed the printer like a domestic pet, he walked to his big desk in the centre of the room. His movements were exaggerated and almost grotesquely precise, as though he had to conform to a set routine. If he did not, then ill luck would be upon him.
"Hello, Josh."
Ronnie waited for the man to settle himself behind the desk.
"Got a favour to ask you?"
"Favours can cost, Walt."
"Have I ever let you down?"
"You're a pleasure to do business with, Walt."